the United States versus Romero. Mr. Ruth.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Ruth, and I represent Ricardo Romero in this particular case. I want to address our three main arguments: the exclusion of Mary Jane Almeida's prior testimony, the sufficiency of the evidence, and whether the government proved that the substance in this case was actually crack. And I want to address these arguments by going directly to the potential weaknesses for us. The first is this business of Mary Jane Almeida's prior testimony. And I think that the $10,000 question is, was the prior statement inconsistent? And if you agree with us that it was inconsistent, and this, by the way, is the weakest potential part of our argument, if it was inconsistent, everything else falls into place. Because you've got, if it is inconsistent, a prior sworn statement that her original story to the police was the truth is directly contrary to her trial testimony. Her trial testimony, and I asked her, was that first story to the police the truth? No, she said, at trial.
But that was the story about the drug dealing, not the story about the battery, right? And isn't it clear from the context that what she was being questioned about in the prior action in state court was what she told the police about the battery?
Your Honor, that is the heart of it. That is the heart of it. It's and if you disagree with me on this, we lose, okay? But it wasn't, the questioning wasn't about the battery. Read that transcript, Exhibit 17, I believe, or Exhibit 20, the transcript of the state court proceedings. And Mary Jane Almeida explained what her prior testimony was about and what her statement to the police was about, okay? She was originally stopped. She was taken into the police department, and she was asked two separate things. She was asked about Ricardo Romero's whereabouts the night before, and she was asked about the cookie tin. Okay, she testified to this, that those are the two lines of questioning. And the preliminary hearing in the state case, that was about, Ricardo Romero was charged with solicitation of perjury because he called Mary Jane and said, asked her, tell him I was with you the night before at your house or something to that effect, okay? So the DA is asking her questions about that, and he asks her some very specific questions about what she told the police and what Ricky Romero said and that sort of thing. Then, in summary, without any qualification, he asks, the DA asks, and was your, is what, I don't want to butcher it up here. Is what you told the detectives that night the truth? Okay? That's the question. Now, I agree that most of what they talked about in that preliminary hearing was about Ricardo Romero's whereabouts. But in this summary question, they offered no the DA offered no qualification. He asked the general question, was your statement to the detectives that night the truth? He didn't say, was your statement about where Ricky was the night before the truth? Was your statement about the battery the truth? In fact, they never even talked about the battery. Was your statement to the detectives that night the truth? And she answered with an unqualified yes. Now, I concede that a reasonable juror may see it the way you see it. A reasonable juror may say, that may be her explanation. She may be able to, in a convincing way, say, I understood the question as to, I interpreted a qualification. Even though there wasn't one, I interpreted it based on the context, and so I thought all he was talking about was, did you tell him the truth about the other stuff? And if she can say that in a convincing way, then so be it.
Well, given that ambiguity, wasn't the district court within its discretion to exclude this line of questioning because it would have been just engulfed the trial in a lot of satellite issues?
No, Your Honor, because first, it would not have engulfed the trial in satellite issues. That's what the government tries to argue in its brief. It's a very short transcript. It's a very to-the-point transcript. And it's a very critical issue in the case. Now, remember, she told a different story the first time. When she got to the point, and she says at trial now, I lied. The first story was a lie. I asked her, was the first story true? No, it was a lie. Okay? So this is the heart of the case. If the first story's true, we're acquitted. If the second story is true, we're convicted. So it's the heart of the case. It's a short transcript. It's very much to the point. And it's the critical issue. Was the statement the truth? Yes. So, I should also point out, Your Honor, the district court did not do the sort of analysis that you're proposing. The district court, and nor did the government argue. The government never said, oh, it's going to bog down the trial. Oh, it's a collateral issue. The government never said, oh, it's going to bring in all this other evidence. And the government never made any argument that there was any prejudice to the government, or I should say any unfair prejudice. There is prejudice.
Didn't the court observe that to go down that road would have gotten into all of the facts and circumstances of the state court prosecution for perjury and didn't want to go there?
No, that's not it. That's the government's spin on it. What she said was, that would be your worst fear, and I don't want to go there. She was as a favor to the defense, she was basically saying that would open the door to evidence about the perjury. Okay? She said to me, that would be your worst fear, and I don't want to go there. And I said, we don't fear it. Go ahead. Bring in the perjury. And quite frankly, I don't see it as damning evidence because he called up his girlfriend and asked her to lie, but only about his whereabouts the night before. He never said anything about any cookie tin, so I submit it suggests that he didn't know anything about the cookie tin. So we don't fear that evidence. Go ahead and bring it in. And we said that. And then the district court said, well, that when she had no response to that other than to say, well, it's a different matter. It's a different matter. So none of the things that you are talking about now as potential problems were raised by the government or addressed by the district court. The biggest thing was, it's a different matter. Well, so what? It's a prior sworn statement on this subject.
Maybe. Now,
pardon?
Maybe.
A reasonable inference. That's all I need. A reasonable juror could agree with me. And that's all I need. And I'll concede that a reasonable juror could disagree with me. But all we need is a reasonable inference. And this is the critical issue of the case. Which story was true, the first one or the second one? If there's nothing there, why did the government jump on this so quickly? Read the transcript. That every time the question's asked, the government pounces. Objection. Sustained. Sustained. I try it again. Objection. Sustained. Sustained. Wouldn't let us get a word in edgewise about this. That if I'm wrong, if my inference is wrong, if my inference is unreasonable, there's no harm to the government by this. The question is, I ask the question, well, this is your prior testimony. Yes. And she can say, but I wasn't talking about this. That's it. It's all over. That's the end of it. But that wouldn't have been it, and the government knows that wouldn't have been it, and that's why it was a big deal in this particular case. I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Dan, did you have a question? All right, thank you, Mr. Ruth. Mr. Geyer?
Good morning. If it pleases the court, I'm Dave Geyer, and I represent Raul Romero in this case. Unlike Mr. Ruth's legal arguments, mine come more to the factual context of the pre-sentence investigation report, the testimony at the sentencing hearing, and whether or not the court in this instance committed clear error. With respect to the clear error section, there's items I would like to just go through some of the cases that were cited by both the government and Mr. Romero, and to try to distinguish this from some of the generic type of cases. One of the cases that was cited was the Berthume case, which basically says that if there's a dispute between or a conflict between a testimony, the trial court's in the best position to make that determination, and at that point, and this court then will very rarely overrule based on or find clear error in that situation. I recall Mr. Berthume's case because I argued that. And the facts in Mr. Berthume was a little different. In that case, there was a discussion regarding guns, trading guns for drugs. Two witnesses testified before the district court, and that was the factual predicate then where this court said where district court makes a determination between one or more witnesses or the credibility that this is what it goes to. In this case, the argument is not that the court there was credibility issues, but rather what was said and what wasn't said before the court in this case and why the court can make its determination. It's our position the court, at least, is related, first of all, to the Kennedy Heights 1,000-gram conspiracy, made a leap from what was testified to and what was presented in either the PSI or through the testimony, and a conspiracy. And again, the facts are set forth in the case, and I've limited myself to give Mr. Ruth some extra time today, so I don't necessarily need to go through all the facts. But I believe that the facts will demonstrate, if the court looks at all the facts and the testimony as well as the PSI, Mr. Suarez was supposedly Mr. Raul Romero's right-hand man or one of his persons who he bought drugs for. Our argument is that Mr. Romero, Raul Romero, merely referred a regular customer to his brother's house that day to buy some drugs. There was testimony by Special Agent Growalski that this was the only time that there was ever a buy at that place, that there were seven controlled buys by the government, never again at this particular location. Mr. Suarez, who was supposedly the right-hand man, never testified nor told the PSI that there was a conspiracy at that particular location. In fact, I believe the facts come through that he, when the CI showed up, he thought it was going to be a marijuana buy, because that's what Mr. Anthony Romero usually did. So we, again, would posit that it is more along the street-level buyer type of situation, that those facts are more consistent with that type of relationship than it is with a conspiracy.
I thought the count of conviction here for your client was a transaction in the parking lot of Kennedy Heights, which would seem to be enough to link him to what was going on in the apartment at
Well, if I may, Your Honor, just unfactually, at the apartment itself, that's where this 1,000 grams was right. located, and a transaction occurred there. Mr. Raul Romero lived at another place, Havy, a residence in Madison that's nearby. The drugs that came to that transaction in the parking lot at Kennedy Heights came from Mr. Raul Romero's place at Havy, and the transaction just took place in a parking lot. It didn't. The drugs themselves were not located in the Kennedy Heights apartment complex, as it was with the 1,000 kilogram one. So this is just, you know, if somebody goes there, they send somebody there to a parking lot to conduct a transaction, and I believe that was a 1 ounce transaction. But the drugs themselves were not located at Kennedy Heights. They were located at another location, as well as all of the other transactions that occurred were at different places other than Kennedy Heights. And I believe the record demonstrates that these were all different locations, different individuals involved. In fact, Mr. Suarez wasn't involved. Mr. Anthony Romero wasn't involved. Other individuals were involved in those transactions.
Well, given the relationship of these brothers and the evidence of the dealing that he was convicted of, why isn't that enough to create a basis to reasonably infer that he knew about what was going on in the apartment itself?
Well, knowledge itself doesn't mean you're involved in the conspiracy. I mean, I can know street-level people know a lot of things that are going on. The mere fact that they're brothers, I guess it's you shouldn't be punished more because you're brothers, and the inference you should know more, as opposed to whether or not what the transactions really were. I mean, these guys were wire. I mean, there were wiretaps on these guys. There were controlled buys. And to make the quantum leap that because of one time this person went there, if this is a drug house or a place where transactions normally take place, all of the surveillance would tend then, you would think, to demonstrate that there were three or four buys there, that a lot of people went in there. I will reserve, well, I guess I better keep on going because I have to get Mr. Turner in here. With respect to Mr. Turner, again, I believe that the court's reliance on any statement by Mr. Turner should be taken with more than a grain of salt, considering that he testified to certain things, told defense counsel other things, and the government tries to back up underpin Mr. Turner's testimony or his statement to the court, to the pre-sentence investigative writer or the investigators, with Mr. Suarez. But again, Mr. Suarez never testified that he had any transactions with Mr. Turner. The inference is that Mr. Raul Romero got drugs, and therefore, because Turner said he bought drugs from Mr. Romero during the same period of time that Suarez was getting drugs, that somehow that bolsters up the facts. Again, there is no factual relationship or nexus between Turner and Suarez which would allow the district court to make that determination. I'll reserve whatever time I have left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Skyer. Mr. Reinhart.
Thank you, Your Honors. David Reinhart for the United States. I'd like to first address the issues raised by Mr. Ricardo Romero and his appeal and talk about the impeachment issue. The district court did not abuse its discretion when it limited the impeachment of Mary Jane Almeida. And I think the court, in this particular case, is correct. The defendant attempted to impeach Mary Jane Almeida with a statement made by her in a totally different context, a totally different case, and a totally different issue. And the court was there to observe it, and the court recognized it, and the court sustained the government's objections on it, and it shut down the questioning. And it shut down the questioning because it didn't want to confuse the jury, didn't want to confuse the issues in the case. And all that's talked about in that transcript is the April 29th incident regarding the battery. There's nothing in regards to the cocaine transaction in that transcript. And in the court's reasoning, in the transcript, the court does talk about those issues and gives a basis for her ruling on page 1A, 140 of the transcript. The court states, "I understand what you're saying, but given that this transcript covers and the focus that the preliminary hearing had, I don't think it's fair to examine on that transcript." And again, later on, the court states, "No, I don't want to get into it. It is a completely different proceeding, and talking about what was going on in there, I think, would be the worst of your fears." And then the court states again, "But we're focusing on an entirely different situation." Also, Mr. Ruth made the point that he would have liked to have asked Mary Jane Almeida whether this was a different situation or not. On page 142, 1A-142, Mr. Ruth has that opportunity, and he asked her. His question was, "Did he ask you if you told the detectives the truth that night?" And her answer, "There is a different, I don't understand if you're asking about this case, it was a different case entirely." So clearly she was even confused as to what question he was asking to her. And I think another point to be made in this particular case is that the defendant did have an opportunity to impeach on this area. He impeached her on her discrepancy between her first statement and her second statement. He brought out the omissions that she made in that first statement. He thoroughly examined that, and that his point was made. Now talking about moving on to the issues involved in Raul Romero's case, specifically the district court's determination of Raul Romero's relevant drug conduct, and the court did not commit clear error in this particular case. The 2.5 kilos was a conservative estimate. The court didn't even include over 5 kilograms attributed by Jose David Suarez during his testimony at sentencing. The defendant specifically challenges two findings. The first challenge is to the 1 kilogram of cocaine seen by Jacourtney Ticey at his brother's apartment on Kennedy Heights apartment complex. And the second is the 850 grams attributed by Danny Turter. First, talking about the 1 kilo. The 1 kilo was reasonably foreseeable. The defendant was just at his brother's house just prior to Ticey observing that kilo. Another important fact is that the defendant facilitated the deal with Ticey involving an ounce from that stash of cocaine, from that kilogram of cocaine. And in a telephone call just prior to that deal, the defendant indicated to Ticey, "I will call my brother. I will have it waiting." I mean, that shows that they were in cahoots, that they were co-conspirators. I mean, that shows that they were sharing inventory at that apartment. They were sharing that stash of cocaine. Also, in addition to that, you have wiretap intercepts testified by Agent Growalski that the defendant was directing other customers to that apartment complex at Kennedy Heights. And finally, as Judge Sykes pointed out, in the defendant's guilty plea, he admitted to dealing drugs from his brother's apartment, adding further credibility to that argument. So the kilo was reasonably foreseeable. Finally, the 850 grams attributed by Danny Turner. Once again, this was a conservative estimate. The court could have attributed 60 ounces. Instead, all it attributed was 30 ounces. And the court credited two statements given under oath versus the statement, the unsworn statement given by Danny Turner. And the court had an opportunity to view Mr. Turner during trial and had an opportunity to evaluate his credibility. So this determination is not clearly erroneous. Based on the arguments and the brief submitted, I would rest at this time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Reinhart. Mr. Rube.
A couple of points about this Mary Jane Almeida's prior inconsistent statement. Read the trial court transcript. At every moment that this is talked about, you will find out that the district court never once said it's a different context. The court never once said that. She said it's a different proceeding. And then Mr. Reinhart did what I was going to do. He quoted what the judge said about that. And it wasn't that it was going to complicate the trial. It wasn't that it was going to bog down the proceedings. It wasn't that it was unfair to the government. It was, her reason was, that it's my worst fear, getting into what that case was about, the perjury. It isn't our worst fear, and we're not bring on that evidence because it isn't anything that hurts us. And I'll tell you what, if it did hurt us a little bit, when you balance it with an admission from the government's lead witness that her trial testimony is false, I'll take that any day of the week. The other part about this prior statement is, I asked it in two different contexts. First, I asked her about her prior sworn statement. I had the transcript in my hand. I had the question. I had the answer. The judge said, no, you can't do that. Okay? Now the government has said, well, that was because of, didn't want to bog down the proceedings or out of context or whatever. I asked the very same question. I said, with a little different twist, I said, all right, now we're not talking about what you said in court. Okay, did you interview with the prosecutor before you went into the prelim? Yes, I did. And did he ask you this same exact question? I don't remember. Now the government objected. In the district court, the government said, that's the same question, Your Honor. And they were right. It was the same question, just at a different moment in time. And the district court said, no, that's okay. So to credit the district court with some reasoning that it was out of context or that it was going to bog down the proceedings or that it was unfairly prejudicial is to just make that up. The district court didn't have that any sort of reasoning like that. And she was prepared to let that statement in as long as we tweaked the context a little bit. As long as we made it the interview before court instead of the actual court proceedings. I asked the very same question. Now, I also want to touch on the business of this. Did the government prove that it was crack cocaine? And it's U.S. versus Edwards. It really didn't plow any new ground. But all of a sudden now, this is all we want to talk about, is did they prove that it was crack cocaine? And I have to concede that defendants and appellants have been losing on this ever since Edwards. This is the case that we're not going to lose because they didn't bring in any evidence. The best they had, they brought in the detective, 10 years on the force, experience, blah, 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 and he says with a punch on direct, I've never seen cocaine base produced by a solvent method. Okay, so must all be crack. But then he has to concede on cross, he has no idea what cocaine base by a non-solvent method looks like. He has to agree, and it's too bad we don't have the actual substances here, but the district court looked at him and she agreed. They were the same texture. The cocaine hydrochloride and the cocaine base were the same texture. And even Helgren, the detective of 10 years, had to concede they are the same texture. I think he said they are equally chunky and similarly chunky. That was what he testified to. So we've got the same texture with a slightly different color. And then he says, I don't know what the color of cocaine base looks like when it's made by a non-solvent method. Well, if he doesn't know, How could he possibly testify to it?
Mr. Ruth, did we have testimony here about being crack prices?
No. No.
The detective didn't say that the CI said he purchased crack and it was crack prices?
No. What he said about that, Judge, if I may, he said that, and the government points this out in their brief, Helgren said the reason why he knows what crack looks like is because in the past he has purchased crack with crack prices. So they talk about crack, they use the price for crack, and then he looks at it and says, that must be crack. That's all he had. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ruth. Mr. Geyer.
Thank you. I'll be rather brief here. Just in response to some of the issues that Mr. Reinhart raised, again, the court has in front of it in the sentencing transcript, so I don't need to go through that in much great detail. All I would refer to the court to is that when Mr. Suarez, after his direct testimony saying how many times he had purchased and how many months he had purchased, on cross-examination he said, I really don't know how many months. It could have been 2 months, the 4 months, or 8 months, and he really didn't know how many times he had purchased. So, again, I believe even in the context of the sentencing itself, Mr. Suarez, who is one of the main characters or witnesses, couldn't even tell under oath how many times he had purchased or what he had purchased out there. With respect to the sworn versus unsworn statement, I know the government has posited in their brief that courts will routinely tell juries. We don't have a jury situation here. Again, we've got a statement that the guy signed, said, I didn't buy that much drugs from Mr. Raul Romero, and he's got this. And I was not present at either the grand jury nor the other trial because my guy wasn't involved in it, as to what he stated. I didn't have an opportunity to cross-examine, so I think all that should be taken in that context. And I believe that's my time, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Geyer. All right, thanks to all counsel. Mr. Ruth and Mr. Geyer, you have an additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment and ably representing the Romeros on appeal. Case is taken under advisement.